Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Coming up this hour, as part of our election coverage, we'll discuss the arguments for and against Proposition 16, which seeks to reinstate affirmative action in California. But first, millions are mourning U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who passed away on Friday at age 87 after a long bout with pancreatic cancer. She was a trailblazer in the fight for gender equality and a stalwart of the court's liberal wing. And joining us now to reflect on her life and legacy is Margaret Russell, Associate Professor of Law, Santa Clara University School of Law. Welcome, Margaret Russell.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's in the last 72 hours, there's been a huge outpouring of grief for Justice Ginsburg. And today it was announced that she would be the first woman to lie in state at the U.S. Capitol. Margaret Russell, tell us why you think Justice Ginsburg connected so deeply with the general public.
There's several reasons. I'll start with the notorious RBG moniker and maybe work my way backwards. She was just spectacularly humorous. This tiny woman, jokingly called the sort of a similar name as a rapper. And she said, well, what we have in common is we're both from Brooklyn. But I think even deeper than that, that women of many generations and all different ages and backgrounds related to the proud, determined way that she carried herself from a time when women were just 3% of lawyers, when she graduated from law school and started out, through a lot of personal discrimination she suffered, and through a very interesting and full life right up until Friday. She's just a very admirable person.
Well, she wasn't the first female justice, but arguably in the mind of the public, she's the most prominent.
I think that is true, that Sandra Day O'Connor was the first justice. And I read a quote that relayed an interesting conversation between Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that Sandra Day O'Connor on the court said to her, suppose we had come of age at a time when women lawyers were welcome at the bar. You know what? Today we would be retired partners from some large law firm. But because that route was not open to us, we had to find another way. And we both ended up on the United States Supreme Court. I think she certainly had a much higher profile and was a more liberal justice than Sandra Day O'Connor, for sure. She is remarkable in other ways that don't have to do with being the only, being such a prominent member, female member of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and I wanted to dive into that because you're a professor of law, and I think it would be interesting for listeners to know some of the cases that she worked on. Obviously, her whip-smart intellect and her incisive writing are qualities that she was widely admired for. But maybe take us through some of the cases where you felt she had a great impact and things that, you know, the average everyday American might not realize that Justice Ginsburg played a role.
Certainly. I'll start with United States versus Virginia, which was a case involving the all-male policy of the Virginia Military Institute. There was a challenge to the policy that limited admission to males because they were essentially stronger and more capable of the adversative training that was necessary in order to be in military training. And she wrote the lead opinion. She actually got six other votes with her. It was 7-1, Clarence Thomas recusing himself because his son went to VMI at the time. And in her majority opinion, she really put forward the boldest articulation of why the Equal Protection Clause protects women. She really pierced through the assumption that there should be a presumption that men and women could be treated differently. She flipped that presumption in her reasoning. She said, instead, the presumption is that they should be treated the same or similarly. And in order to deviate from that, people had to show a very strong justification. She also decided cases in many different areas, Friends of the Earth, which was an environmental lawsuit, the Olmstead case, criminal justice cases, death penalty cases. As you know, the Supreme Court accepts all kinds of cases. And she was known not just for the majority opinions that she wrote very forcefully, but actually for a couple of, you know, very stinging dissents, Bush versus Gore, the gun control case, D.C. versus Heller. Her dissents could gain even more attention than her majority opinions.
Right. And I was thinking of one case, Gonzalez versus Carhart, which was about partial birth abortion, where she actually read her dissent on the from the bench, which is unusual, right? It kind of makes a statement when you actually read the dissent.
Absolutely. And she did choose carefully these ways of conveying her seriousness. One was reading that dissent from the bench. Another was, instead of saying, "I respectfully dissent," as dissenters traditionally do, she just said, "I dissent," in Bush versus Gore. And Gonzalez versus Carhart is an interesting and important case, I think, for her to dissent in, because the reproductive rights of women and abortion itself, they're in a very precarious state right now with the passing of Justice Ginsburg and the imminent appointment of a new person who purportedly is strongly anti-abortion.
Right. And in that case, I think one of her part of her dissent read, "Notwithstanding the bond of love women often have with their children, not all pregnancies are wanted or even the product of consensual activity." So she was very to the point when she had a dissent to say, to offer on things that affected the quality of not just women's lives, but people's lives.
Absolutely. If I could describe her jurisprudence and her approach to the Constitution in one word, it would be justice. She had a sign in her chambers that talked about doing justice, a quote from Deuteronomy. And just starting with the reproductive rights area, doing justice meant respecting the equal rights of women to make choices about their own body. Doing justice in another area of the law would involve, let's say, in the Lilly Ledbetter case in which she dissented, doing justice meant that women could bring suit, should be able to bring suit when they discovered long after they had been hired that they had been systematically underpaid compared to men.
And in that sense, I mean, in the Ledbetter case, where, as you mentioned, it was talking about equal pay for equal work. And in that case, I think the plaintiff, she didn't discover that she was paid lesser than men until later on. And in her dissent, I think Justice Ginsburg said, you know, you can't throw this out on a technicality. Congress needs to fix that. And not too long after that, Congress did fix it. Isn't that right?
That's right. And it was called the Lilly Ledbetter Act, the first bill signed into law in the first term of Barack Obama. And justice is actually can have frequently dissented or written opinions in which they say, this is the role of Congress. If the way to change this is not through the courts, it's through Congress. And this was clearly a signal for Congress to go in that direction.
I think that case is interesting too, because it really shows us how the branches of government are intertwined and they can interact with each other. I mean, that in that dissent, Justice Ginsburg was kind of laying out a path forward to correct a problem, which Congress then took up the cause on. So it's not like the Supreme Court, sometimes we think of it as on this high pedestal, it just issues rulings that come from on high, but there's really a tension that works. The justices are trying to interpret the Constitution, and that can influence Congress.
Absolutely. And the system of checks and balances in the first three articles of the Constitution are really the bedrock principles on which Supreme Court justices make decisions. So it's not a court of policy. It's not a court of aspirational opinion on a particular issue. It is, first of all, a question of whether or not the question presented is something that a court should decide. And then after that, once it's in that door, a question of, as Ginsburg said, the facts, the law. She said she didn't play to home crowds or pander to anyone. She was very precise in her approach legally to her cases.
And I love that you mentioned her precision. I was reading a lot about Justice Ginsburg, as I think a lot of us were this weekend. And in one of the pieces I read, it talked about how when she was a university student at Cornell, one of her English teachers was Vladimir Nabokov, who wrote Lolita. I thought that was pretty amazing. Probably made her a better writer.
That is pretty amazing, actually.
Well, I want to talk about one more case, which is Shelby, which she dissented in. It's a Voting Rights Act case that came up recently. And I think her dissent is one of the reasons I believe a NYU law student was so dismayed by the court's outcome and so empowered by Justice Ginsburg's dissent that she actually, that's where the notorious RBG moniker came from. Can you tell our audience a little bit about Shelby and what Justice Ginsburg did in that case or said in that case?
Certainly. This was a Supreme Court case from 2013 in which there was a challenge to a key provision of the Voting Rights Act, which, as many people know, was a decades-old or is a decades-old piece of legislation passed during the Civil Rights Movement in order to remove barriers in jurisdictions for access to the right to vote. That is still important today. So the majority of the court struck down a key provision that on the basis that times have changed, this isn't the racist country in terms of voting that it used to be, and it is no longer needed. And Ginsburg wrote one of her famous dissents. She said that throwing out the provision, quote, when it has worked and is continuing to work is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet, which was her way of saying racism, racial discrimination, barriers to access to the vote still exist very pervasively, and that the majority was really completely out of touch in saying that times have changed and you no longer need to have those kinds of voting rights protections.
And I think a reason why a dissent like that resonates is, I mean, today and as we all get ready for early voting in various states, we're seeing exactly what Justice Ginsburg talked about.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this has been such a difficult couple of days for those of us who admire and follow Ruth Bader Ginsburg so much. And the fact that it is so close to the election in which there is so much turmoil about whether people are going to get to exercise their voting rights, it just makes the pain all the worse, I think, of losing her.
And how, when you heard that Justice Ginsburg had passed, how did you metabolize that for yourself, Margaret?
Well, it's interesting. Truthfully, I had just come out of a pretty terrible meeting. At the end of the terrible meeting, I start getting texts from a number of friends of mine. I mean, it really was one of those historic moments when my friends were saying, oh my goodness, people are emailing me and texting me, people I haven't been in touch with for a long time because we shared such admiration and love for her. And, I knew that she was 87 and she had battled cancer several times. So she had lived a very rich and full life. But somehow, I guess we all hope that she would live forever.
I know. You always hope that for the good ones. Well, before I let you go, I think an aspect of Justice Ginsburg's life that we're all reading about more is just the depth of her friendships and the collegiality that she showed her colleagues. It's something that I think we're missing in public life right now. Can you talk a little bit about her relationship, for example, with Justice Scalia, who was doctrinally the exact opposite of her, and yet they were so close?
That's right. It is amazing to think of the caustic things that they said in their opinions, judicial opinions, and yet still remain friends. I think that Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that she loved the fact that he made her laugh, and she and her husband and Scalia and his wife socialized a lot. But I think it speaks a lot to a certain kind of cordiality, which is becoming rarer, that you can find common ground, personal common ground with someone who's very different from you.
Yeah, we missed that. And well, you mentioned also her husband, Martin Ginsburg. He's gotten a lot of press in the last couple of days as well. They had a famously collaborative and supportive relationship, a marriage. And then he got to be played by Armie Hammer in the movie On the Basis of Sex, which is not so bad.
Right.
Maybe for our listeners who don't know about the Ginsburg marriage, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, they met and married very, you know, quite young when they were still going through law school, I believe. And early in her career, perhaps even in law school, Ruth Bader Ginsburg took care of her husband as well as raised kids when he had cancer. What is so remarkable, not just in the movie, but in the documentary, is what a great cheerleader he was of his wife's work. And there are the things like he was a great chef and he cooked dinner and he loved being the one who was at home while she went upstairs and worked well into the night. But when she had a chance to be nominated by Bill Clinton to the United States Supreme Court, he was a very avid lobbyist on her behalf. And I think the documentary explains how many letters and calls, and she's so great. And apparently it worked.
Yeah, it's a modern relationship that I think a lot of people aspire to, knowing as we're learning more and having seen the documentary, it's thinking like my partner should be that way for me. So let's all be a Marty Ginsburg.
Right. Well, that's when they do hashtag relationship goals, right?
Yeah, it should be a Marty Ginsburg. Well, let me ask you this. Who's going to hold on to Justice Ginsburg's legacy now that she's gone on the court? Will it be Justices Kagan and Sotomayor? Will Justice Breyer take the lead? Who do you think will take that leadership position?
Well, of course, no one can replace sort of the historical meaning and trajectory of her life, going from a time when women were just 3% of all lawyers until the present day. But I think Sonia Sotomayor is the closest. She has a very bold voice, both in oral argument and in her decisions, a very distinctive bold voice. And in that sense, I think she will be a force on the court, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg was.
Well, we'll look to that. And finally, last question, what should listeners not take for granted about Justice Ginsburg's legacy?
I would say it's that she actually, long before she was a judge, she was a litigator, ACLU Women's Rights Project, and a law professor. And notably, as a litigator, she made the arguments and created the law that she then was able to apply what she said on the Supreme Court. I think that's pretty remarkable.
Right. She had a lasting impact on us all. Well, I want to thank you, Margaret Russell, for sharing your thoughts and giving us that sort of insider look to the laws and courts cases that she worked on. That was, again, Margaret Russell, professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
To hear more about Justice Ginsburg, listeners should tune in tomorrow, Wednesday at 6 p.m. for Your Legal Rights, where host Jeffrey Hayden, he's going to have an all-star lineup of lawyers and judges and legal professors to discuss Justice Ginsburg's ongoing legacy. And on Thursday, KLW is going to be rebroadcasting at noon the BINA program, in which the RBG biographer Jane Sheeran DeHart will be speaking. Coming up next, is now the time to overturn California's 25-year ban on affirmative action? We'll speak to both a supporter and opponent of Prop 16 when we come back. Ago, California's voters passed a proposition which put a ban on affirmative action in state institutions. Now, as protests over racial injustice continue, the country is reckoning with its history of systemic racism. Against that backdrop, this November, Californians will vote on Proposition 16, which aims to bring back affirmative action. Supporters of the measure believe that reinstating affirmative action will help offset persistent inequalities based on race and gender. However, opponents argue that Prop 16 will legalize discrimination and potentially hurt groups it's trying to help, like Asian Americans. With the election only a few weeks away and voters being encouraged to return their ballots early, what do we need to know about Prop 16 to inform our vote? Joining us now to talk about Prop 16, we have Richard H. Sander. He's an economist and professor of law at UCLA and also the co-author of the book Mismatch: How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you for having me, Grace.
We also have Vincent Pan. He's the executive director of Chinese for Affirmative Action and co-chair of the Opportunity for All Coalition Steering Committee. Welcome, Vincent.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great. But first, we're going to hear about the current status of Prop 16 in California from Jeremy B. White. He's a journalist and co-author of Politico's California Playbook. Welcome, Jeremy.
Hey, Grace.
Hi. So, Jeremy, give us a lay of the land. We had Prop 209, which was passed in 96, which banned affirmative action. And now we have this new proposition. How did it get onto the ballot and why are we looking at it right now?
So, as you mentioned, Grace, it's been a couple decades at this point since California voters banned race-conscious university admissions and hiring via Proposition 209. There have been multiple attempts since then by the legislature to put this issue before voters again. They haven't really gone anywhere. But this year, we saw something different. In order to put an initiative on the ballot, the legislature needs two-thirds votes in both houses, which is a fairly heavy lift. But this time, some of the sort of rising national consciousness around racial equality really helped power it to the ballot in a way that we haven't seen in recent years. And so now it's up to the voters.
And how would you characterize the impact of Prop 209, that constitutional amendment, over the last 25 years?
You know, there have been a variety of studies on this. An organization like called the Equal Justice Society has estimated that minority and women-owned businesses lost around $1 billion a year in public contracts since its passage. An overlooked part of affirmative action is that it doesn't just apply to university admissions, it also applies to public hiring and contracting. But at public universities, which is where a lot of the attention really focuses on this issue, there's been a lot of evidence that essentially the population, the student population of these schools, particularly the flagship University of California campuses, just hasn't kept pace as California has grown more diverse. So, for example, the University of California President's Office, before the regents endorsed Prop 16, put together a memo which found that university admissions from so-called underrepresented communities hit about 37% in 2016. The state population was about 56%. So a fairly substantial gap in terms of California's college-age population versus people who are getting admitted to these schools.
Well, you made a good point, Jeremy, which is that we talk a lot about affirmative action in the context of university or law school, kind of graduate school admissions. And I think a little bit less about the fact that this proposition, as I understand it, is affecting affirmative action as it applies to all state institutions. So you mentioned contracts. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How would affirmative action have a role in contracts?
Certainly. Both in contracts and in hiring for public positions, in the past, before Prop 209 became the law of the land, there was some ability for public institutions to give some consideration to factors like race, gender, when they were deciding which businesses get a public contract and who should be hired for a job. Since then, that's been prohibited. So that has played out in various ways. As I said, there's evidence that contracts to minority and women-owned businesses have dropped sharply since then in terms of civil servants in California's public workforce, even as the Latino population has grown massively in the intervening decades. There's quite a lag as well in terms of Latino Californians working in public positions.
So you were mentioning earlier too that the kind of current climate that we're in is one of the reasons why this proposition was able to get on the ballot in the first place. But in a presidential election where people are so focused on the top of the ballot, what's being done for both the pro and the con side of the proposition to engage voters and get them to pay attention to this?
So the campaign has been fairly quiet so far. I should point out that the pro side, the people who want to reinstate affirmative action, have a massive cash advantage right now over the no side. It's somewhere in the area of $12 million that they've raised. But we haven't seen a huge amount of advertising yet. And I think that was reflected in some recent polling, which showed that this initiative is lagging pretty far behind. And something like a fifth of likely voters said they had no opinion on it. And historically, when it comes to ballot initiatives, when voters don't have a strong opinion, they don't really know what something does, they tend to just not vote, which if you're trying to get to 51% is often effectively a no vote. And so I expect the campaign is going to intensify in the 5 weeks or so we have between now and the election. But it's clear that the yes side really has some work to do if they want to get this over the finish line.
Mm-hmm. And can you help us put it in context on a national level? So in California, the constitutional amendment says that you can't discriminate on the basis of race, sex, gender, ethnicity, effectively no affirmative action in this state. Is that a case across the country? Is that the case on the federal level?
So California is one of only a few states, I believe one of nine total, but certainly a minority of states that have an explicit ban on affirmative action like this. The Supreme Court has adjudicated this issue a couple times since California passed Proposition 209. So on the federal level, the Supreme Court invalidated explicit racial quotas, you know, saying you have to admit such and such percentage or number of a particular ethnic group. But it did preserve university admissions and public decisions that factor in race, gender, ethnicity as one of a variety of factors to increase campus diversity. So the Supreme Court essentially said the goal of increasing campus diversity and giving some weight to things that would help with that, that's okay. It can't just be the single determinative factor.
So the private universities across the country can basically look to race, among other factors, and admissions. But in California, state institutions cannot. So does that mean that at Stanford, they can look to race and ethnicity, and at Cal, they cannot? Or is it just nobody can use it?
That's an excellent question. And I'm embarrassed to say I don't know the answer for certain on that. The text of Proposition 209 says the state shall not discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to. So insofar as it's a private institution, the rules may be different, but I don't want to give your voters, or excuse me, your listeners, the wrong impression on that one. So I may have to defer to the experts. I'm sure somebody on the pro or the anti side can answer that one.
Well, we'll definitely kick that question to them. So so on education, employment, and contracts, affirmative action could make a huge difference, according to the supporters. And what are the people, we're going to talk a little bit more with our panel, but what's the what are they saying on the no side?
So opponents of this would tell you that whereas proponents say it's something to guarantee equal access and justice, opponents would say that it's a form of legalized discrimination because you can essentially say that somebody's immutable characteristics, the group they belong to, help to determine their fate. That's an argument that you hear from a lot of opponents who say, of course, everybody loves diversity, but this isn't really about diversity. In their view, it's about legalized discrimination, essentially. And then there's an argument that I believe we're going to hear from one of your guests, which is an interesting one, that essentially this has led to some folks being admitted to universities who maybe were not prepared for the coursework and end up dropping out or having lower educational attainment in a way that sort of undercuts the goal of this proposition. I think a thing you have to understand about what makes this such a thorny political issue is that a lot of the political dynamics have sort of broken down historically along ethnic lines. And so you've seen a lot of concern about this policy amongst Asian Americans in California who fear it would mean losing out on opportunities to get some of these finite seats in these competitive public universities. When it fell apart in the legislature the previous time, we really saw a dynamic in which Latino and African-American lawmakers were pushing for it, and some Asian-American lawmakers really balked after hearing from their constituents. Now, obviously, Asian-American community is a huge and diverse one. I don't want to suggest it's a monolith, but there was a quote that really struck me from a Asian-American lawmaker who has a heavily Asian-American district when this hit the assembly floor. And he said, quote, "It's about fear, it's about race, it's about the loss of power." And he said, particularly the Chinese community fear the loss. And so, of course, supporters will dispute that this has to be a zero-sum game, but it often really does come down to that of, you know, who's going to get these finite spots at Berkeley or contracts.
Right. Well, you've given us a really good background on the fight over this particular proposition. And I want to thank you, Jeremy White from Politico's California Playbook, for joining us. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, Grace.
And we want to hear from you, our listeners. Do you think affirmative action should be restored at state institutions in California? Why or why not? Give us a call or ask us some questions for our guests. The number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email to cityvisions@kalw.org or find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisions@kalw. And I want to turn to my guests tonight. Again, that's Vincent Pan for Chinese for Affirmative Action. And Vincent, you're a sponsor of Prop 16, so I wanted to go to you next. In 1996, the Proposition 209 amended the Constitution, and it does say the state cannot discriminate against or grant preferential treatment based on race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin. What's so wrong with that?
Well, I think the thing to know about Proposition 209 is that the language was very deceptive. You know, putting into the language that the ban on discrimination was really superfluous. It was unnecessary. It's there in federal law. And so it didn't really, you know, prevent any type of discrimination in the state. What it did do, though, was ban so-called preferential treatment, which has since come to be understood as just race and gender conscious programs in general. And so I think that when we look at the exit polls from 1996, we do see that still super majorities of African Americans, Latinos and Latinas, and Asian Americans voted against it. But now that the electorate has changed, we feel confident that once we explain how affirmative action is a very powerful tool to advance both racial and gender equality, that the voters will understand that this is a good thing for California.
Well, tell us, how is it a good thing for California?
Well, I think we're seeing across the country and here in California a moment of racial reckoning, and that, of course, began a long time ago, but certainly with the murder of George Floyd, people of all backgrounds recognizing that we're not doing nearly enough as a society to fulfill the promise of everyone being able to contribute and live up to their potential. I think the COVID pandemic also is laying bare just horrible disparities where literally communities of color are dying at disproportionate rates, and where small businesses, many owned by women and people of color, are not only being shuttered, but shut out from many of the federal assistance programs that ought to support them. So in our view, Prop 16 is a powerful way to advance opportunity for everyone, and that's racial and gender equality on the ballot. It's what Justice Ginsburg stood for in her writings on affirmative action. It's what leaders like Senator Kamala Harris are in support of and have endorsed our campaign. And so I think that we do have some work to explain to folks that not only is this going to help Californians in the short term, but really I think enable us as a society to take more seriously and take some practical measures to address opportunity for all.
Right. And I'd like to now go to our guest, Richard Sander. He's the economist and professor of law at UCLA. Professor Sander, what's wrong with Prop 16?
Well, first of all, let's start with this business of affirmative action. Affirmative action can take several different forms. One is outreach to minority communities. Another is trying to do a better job of creating a level playing field in admissions and selection processes. All those traditional forms of affirmative action were unaffected by Prop 209. And the irony is that the University of California actually started using those tools after Prop 209 passed, because the administrators found they could no longer just use racial preferences to achieve the level of diversity what they wanted. So they dramatically increased their outreach levels. They dramatically increased the number of partnerships between UC colleges and disadvantaged high schools. The university started taking individual socioeconomic characteristics into account in a significant way. And the result of that was actually a dramatic improvement in how underrepresented minorities were both represented and performed at the University of California. So I'm looking at the numbers in front of me right now, which is that in 1997, the year before Prop 2 and I went into effect, underrepresented minorities made up 18% of new freshmen at the University of California. In 2017, 20 years later, that number had gone from 18% to almost 38%. That's actually a much better representation than existed before Prop 2 and 9. The overall percentage of URMs in California went from 41 to 53% during that time. So a 13-point increase in the base population of high school graduates, but a more than doubling in the representation at UC. So, you know, Prop 2 and 9, if you actually look at the facts, it's been an amazing success. It hasn't been a zero-sum game. It's actually been a positive-sum game because we stopped discriminating against whites and Asians, and we created much better opportunities for Hispanics and African Americans than they had had before.
What do you say to critics of that? I mean, that statistic has been played a lot that, you know, the UC system is having its most diverse in terms of Black and Brown students incoming class, but the percentage of kids who have been admitted doesn't reflect proportionally the percentage of the population of students who could actually go there. So although it has increased, so has for in the last 25 years, so has the number of kids who have in that particular admissions pool.
But the three things you need to keep in mind are, first of all, the representation has improved. So underrepresented minorities are much better represented than they were before Prop 2 and 9, and that's directly a result of these other types of legal affirmative action. Number two is that University of California is not supposed to randomly select high school graduates. They're actually supposed to pick people who are in the relatively, you know, high-performing academics. And it's a reality, an unfortunate reality, but it is a reality that Hispanics and Blacks have lower academic performance in high school than whites and Asians do. So if you're going to take academic preparation into account, then underrepresented minorities are actually overrepresented in the University of California system relative to either whites or Asians. So this representation argument really falls apart when you just look at the actual realities of what the university administrators face.
Right, and we have a caller, Starchild, I think from San Francisco. Are you there? I guess we've lost him. How about Jonathan from Berkeley?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Welcome to City Visions. What's your question?
So I saw two no on Prop 16 ads on my Facebook, and one of them said that there would be fewer women lawyers admitted to, I think, UC law schools if Prop 16 passes. But I find that kind of a weird kind of argument, and I was wondering if that's exactly what's going to play out with Prop 16.
Vincent, do you want to take that? That if Prop 16 passes, I think you're saying that there'll be fewer women lawyers admitted to UC law schools?
Or yes, fewer law school applicants admitted, yeah.
Well, let me say this just to back up a little bit, because I think what Professor Sander did was did a very selective reading of the available data and really ignored the broader context, which is that Prop 209 was a sweeping ban on race and gender conscious programs, not just in college admissions, but also in public contracting, also in public employment. And so when you look at the reality, if we care about, for example, K-12, 2/3 of our student body are students of color, but only 1/3 of the faculty are. If you look at the UC tenured faculty, it's still 70% men. You know, the loss of contracts, $1.2 billion a year from women-owned and minority-owned businesses. And when we look at the admissions, I think we do need to understand that the increase in representation has happened not because of 209, but despite it. And so the reality of what's happened is that in most instances, local jurisdictions, as well as school districts and universities, have interpreted 209 to basically not go forward with seeking programs to address disparities. Now, it may be different in the instance of UC, where they have explored and pursued other race and gender neutral programs. But in general, the way 209 has been interpreted is to be, well, not only can we do nothing about it, but we won't even go through the thoughtful and rigorous process to understand disparities. The other piece is that since 209 has passed, federal law and constitutional law is always has also constricted. And so in order to be able to pursue race or gender conscious programs, they would need to meet what's known as strict scrutiny. They would need to be narrowly tailored. And in the process of finding those solutions, yes, we may identify race and gender neutral programs to fix the disparities, but that does not mean that those will always be enough. Just to give one, you know, a hypothetical example, if you have a police accountability board that is all white, currently Prop 209 would prevent you from considering the racial background of people who apply to do that work when we know that race is certainly at the heart of much of the police violence that we see. If we want to have a STEM camp to make sure that girls are aware of the opportunities to pursue science and technology under 209, that would be considered sex discrimination. So I think there's a myriad of different types of programs where race and gender conscious affirmative action programs would be reasonable, would be supported by the public, but are currently banned. So with respect to law schools and especially other graduate schools, we do still see underrepresentation of students of color, certainly at the more flagship UC campuses, certainly in the graduate school levels.
Richard Sander, I want to let you respond to that. But first, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're talking about California's Prop 16, a measure that aims to repeal California's nearly 25-year ban on affirmative action. You can join us by calling 866-798-8255 or send us an email to cityvisions@kalw.org. So, Professor Sander,
Grace, can I just respond to your listener's question?
I just
deserves an answer. There is no danger whatsoever of fewer women lawyers if Prop 16 is defeated. Women have made up about half of the law school classes at all the elite law schools for many years now. And I have sat on those admissions committees, and I know for a fact that gender has not been a factor for many, many decades, even before Prop 209 became an issue. This is an example of a sort of a scare tactic that is used to try to generate support, saying, well, we need to have preferences because women are vulnerable. Women are doing great.
Women are doing
more,
great?
More broadly, excuse me.
I just want to make sure I heard that correct. Women are doing great?
Yes, women are doing great. Right. Women make up more than half of our new lawyers in California.
And their partners?
Well,
in leadership?
A feeding process that there's a sort of a lag between when women become lawyers and when they become senior partners at firms, because we can't just sort of get rid of all the old white males who were there in the 80s and 90s. It's a gradual process of attrition. When you take that into account, women are doing quite well throughout.
Is there a wage gap?
I don't think we're going to spend the next 20 minutes interrupting each other. I'd like to finish what I have to say.
Well, Richard Sander, I wanted to ask you specifically, are there things that Prop 209 has prevented us from doing in order to help underrepresented minorities and women? For example, Vincent was talking about STEM camps that can't happen or types of outreach that we're not seeing when it comes to state contracts. Are there things that haven't been happening because of 209?
No, I think just the opposite is the case. As I say, it was really after Prop 209 passed that UC started developing real affirmative action programs. My law school has a critical race studies program. We have a special mentoring program for students coming from disadvantaged schools. We're doing much more than we were before Prop 209 to actually build the pool. And it's having an effect. So in the late 1990s, the high school graduation rate for Hispanics in California was 66%. So one out of three Hispanic high school students dropped out. The high school graduation rate for Hispanics now is 88%. That's a dramatic improvement. That improvement has not happened elsewhere in the country. So we're doing something right. Housing segregation levels in California have dropped more than they have in most other parts of the country. So we're actually doing lots of very progressive things on race in California. This is a progressive state. But instituting discrimination is not really a helpful part of the solution.
Well, let's take another call. We've got Dina from San Jose. Dina, are you there?
Hi, are you able to hear me okay?
Yeah, welcome to City Visions. What's your comment or question?
So I actually wanted to say that I am Filipino and I am underrepresented, but I'm collected in the Asian American numbers. So when you're saying that Asian Americans are doing great, well, actually, there are segments of that population that isn't doing great. And so I wanted to point that out. I also wanted to say that the UCs are actually supporting Prop 16. So I wanted to ask Richard directly, why does he think that is? Thank you.
Thanks for that question. So the UC system is supporting Prop 16. What's your thought on that, Richard Sander?
Well, part of the problem UC administrators face is that they were all opposed to Prop 2 and I when it passed, and a lot of them have trouble saying, gee, you know, it actually turned out a lot better than we thought. We were wrong. Another issue is that they're under very intense pressure from state legislators to increase diversity. And it's hard, as a senior faculty member told me today, it's very hard for people to come out publicly and say, well, there's actually a difference in the qualifications of the applicant pools. And if you take that into account, we're actually doing a great job. Those arguments rarely get heard. Just like it's rarely pointed out that there's a big difference between affirmative action and preferences and discrimination. On the point about Filipinos, I think that's really important to emphasize that one of the great things about a race-neutral regime is that we don't sort of say, well, let's give a bonus to Filipinos and a negative to Chinese Americans, or a bonus to Mexican Americans and a negative to Cuban Americans. Because the reality is that all those groups have very widely different levels of opportunity within their groups. There are wealthy people in each group, and there are disadvantaged people within each group. And what we do now in state operations generally, and UC in particular, is we look at the individual, we look at their particular background, and we give them a hand up if their background is disadvantaged.
Right. We have another caller, Starchild from San Francisco.
Hi.
Hi. What's your comment or question?
I'm a libertarian running for state assembly, starchild.forliberty.org, pansexual. The libertarian position on this basically is that we should really be looking at people's individual merit, not lumping people together into groups. Prop 16 would make institutional racism legal, and I don't think we can ultimately reduce racism by practicing racism, even when the goal is to benefit historically disadvantaged groups, which is a noble goal, but the method is wrong. I'd rather see assistance offered based on people's economic background, which will help people who are, you know, from groups that are disproportionately poor or disadvantaged, without making it explicitly a racist program. And I also think there's this phony presumption that everybody should want lots of people like themselves to get into college. Actually, college is often a ripoff, and instead of people with years of equity debt, many people would be better off not getting into college, especially if they come from poor backgrounds. You know, they do better financially, and they have just as much opportunity to learn today with the internet everywhere and everything. There's so many ways to learn outside of college. So I think there's a question of presumption as well.
Thanks for that comment and that point of view. I think college is really taking a hit right now during COVID. But I wanted to give Vincent Pan a chance to respond to that. Is Prop 16 legitimizing racial discrimination?
No, of course not. I think that what it allows us to do is identify how an individual's background with respect to race or gender or ethnicity factors into their ability to succeed. And so, yes, whether it's college admissions or contract or employment, everyone is still assessed as an individual, but we're essentially allowing the public sector to do what the private sector does already, which is to simply be grown up and understand that people's race and gender has an impact on their lives. It's not the only factor, and it can't be the primary factor, but it is a meaningful factor. And I think most Californians know that, and they know race matters, and know that gender matters. It's a practical way to make sure that those who are currently not able to participate in the ways that we would like are able to do so. And that includes for subgroups within the Asian American community that are very diverse and that do face different challenges. And I don't think we should pretend that the Pacific Islander community, for example, faces the same types of barriers that the Chinese American community does or the Native American community does. By acknowledging this, we can develop and craft programs to make sure that we are able to reduce these disparities.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the political approach to Prop 16. A lot of the conversation about Prop 16 is about emissions to the UC system, which seems to activate a lot of anxiety and fear in people. Everybody wants a chance for their kid to have that spot at Cal or UCLA or UC San Diego. And yet the proposition has a broader outreach than that. And I was reflecting on something that Assemblyman David Chu said from San Francisco, you know, talking about how Asian Americans are universally against Prop 16. And he responded, "That's simply not true. I hear all the time that my Asian American constituents want more teachers who look like us, more principals, university presidents, more first responders, firefighters, bilingual police officers. Current law prevents that." Is that true, Richard Sander? Does current law prevent us, state institutions, from hiring more people who are representative of the communities that they're from?
No, it doesn't. You know, Grace, before I fully answer that, just let me clear up the earlier thing that came up in the news report, which is Stanford and private schools definitely are not affected by Prop 209 and would not be affected by Prop 16. This clearly is just something that applies to the public sector. But, you know, as someone who is involved in hiring decisions at a senior level at the University of California, I can tell you that you know, race is not ignored. Gender is not ignored. We care about diversity. It's just that you can't have sort of the really, you know, we're talking, I think, generally about a thumb on the scale instead of a fist. We're talking about general preferences and awareness and goals as opposed to things that look an awful lot like quotas. So what we're really afraid of with Prop 16 is that it would essentially put the university in a position where they would be under tremendous political pressure to come very, very close to proportional representation. And that would lead to huge disparities. You know, in Berkeley, before Prop 209, the average African-American admit had an SAT 273 points below the average Asian-American admit. That's fist. That's a huge, huge preference. And, you know, it led to terrible academic results for the African-Americans who were admitted. Black graduation rates have doubled since Prop 209 went into effect. Their likelihood of persisting in science majors has tripled. So, you know, this is, as I started out, a win-win thing because minorities are hurt by being discriminated in favor of.
Well, we had a couple emails that have come in as well. Jess writes, "Why not guarantee students in the top 10% of the graduating class entrance into the UC system instead of choosing applicants on the basis of race? It would seem that this would accomplish diversity goals, but also satisfy concerns that applicants should be judged on their academic merits." And Anna writes, "Your guest says Black and Brown students have lower achievement. All UC students meet a minimum scholastic standard. Which UC they get into depends on intangibles. To say their lower numbers are their own fault is ridiculous." Vincent Pan, I wanted to return to you. What about the idea of just guaranteeing students in the top 10% a spot in the UC system, regardless of race or ethnicity or gender?
Well, we do have a system like that. It's not the top 10%. It's lower than that. But, you know, we do have a system that allows those applying from their individual schools in the top percentage to be admitted. So that's in place. And I think that a lot of these other measures would continue to be in place, and whether that's to do supports based on socioeconomic status, whether it's to do supports in other ways, all that's allowed. We're making the case that race and gender are simply too big of a factor to ignore, right? And so even Professor Sanders has recognized that there is an interest in doing that. Now, he says it's better just to do it sort of with a wink and a nod and not actually make the state programs. But I do think that there are many institutions that are not as progressive as UC that do not have that same disposition. And we certainly see that in different parts of government, including in public safety agencies, including in our health response systems. And there we do see how race and gender do continue to be pervasive barriers for too many people. And I think we shouldn't, you know, just talk about UC because that is one place that's important. But 209 was a sweeping ban, and Prop 16 would not mandate affirmative action. It would simply allow it to be legal. Universities like UC would have to take it upon themselves to proactively decide what would be the appropriate way to go forward. And I think that there are many instances throughout the state where big positive gains could be achieved in terms of advancing racial and gender equality if Prop 16 were to pass.
Well, let's take one more call. We've got Koja on the line. Koja, what's your comment or question? Koja, can you hear us?
Hello?
Hi. Welcome to City Visions. What's your comment or question?
Yeah, thank you. I have a question. This question is for Mr. Pan, the Executive Director of Chinese for Affirmative Action. So I know there are two employees of Chinese Communist Party, specifically one of them named Terry Chi is a journalist who worked for China Central Television, which is the biggest CCP-owned TV producing and broadcasting organization for more than 10 years. About a year ago, he came to U.S. as a
Do you have a question in Arizona. About so my, affirmative action? I guess we lost her.
Let me just comment very quickly. So at CIA, we have international students who are here studying abroad who work with the organization, and we're not embarrassed by that at all. But I do want to say that this call does represent the type of misinformation and distraction that many of the opponents of Prop 16 are advancing. You know, just 2 days ago, with the death of Justice Ginsburg, one of their signers for the rebuttal arguments against Prop 16 called her a wicked woman, said she was a psychotic leftist. You know, so I think that there are, and I would hope that Professor Sanders would renounce that, because I do think there is room for, you know, positive discourse about the policy mechanics, about this these attacks about who's on which side would lead us to, I think, a very clear understanding that the Asian Pacific Chamber of Commerce supports Prop 16. The California PTA supports Prop 16. The League of Women Voters supports Prop 16. So this insinuation that somehow Prop 16 is linked to the Chinese Communist Party is really just absurd.
I think you've debunked that. And with the time that we have left, I wanted to give each of you an opportunity to give us the best argument in favor or against the proposition. So I'll start with you, Richard Sander. Why shouldn't we pass Prop 16?
Well, let me first say I agree with Vincent that ad hominem attacks have no place in this campaign. And I want people to look at the facts. And I think my argument, Grace, is that if you really look at the facts, if you look at what's happened to the enrollment numbers, if you look at what's happened to minority achievement at UC, then the case makes itself that this is a bad idea. Prop 209 has actually helped all groups. I think we want to be very, very cautious about giving the government the ability to discriminate. It took a long time to get government to give up that ability. And we want to have really, really compelling arguments and very clear factual cases if we want to restore that. And I just don't think the proponents of Prop 16 have made that case.
Great. And Vincent Pan, we have 30 seconds. What's the best argument in favor of Prop 16?
Well, look, the fight for racial and gender equality is on the ballot in California. We come together to support opportunity for all. Affirmative action does level the playing field for women and people of color. In California, we believe in giving everyone, regardless of race or gender, equal shot at fair wages, good jobs, quality schools. But we're not there. And affirmative action is one powerful tool to be able to do that. It does that without quotas and with a lot of oversight.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. And I want to thank both of my guests, Richard Sander and Vincent Pand, here to talk about Prop 16. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Join us next week as we discuss the Electoral College and whether it's time to eliminate it. Our engineer this evening was Damian Miner. Don't forget, if you want to hear more about Justice Ginsburg, tune in Wednesday at 6 p.m. to Your Legal Rights. And again on Thursday at noon, where Bina will have a rebroadcasting of an interview with Justice Ginsburg's official biographer. Tonight's show was produced by Kendrick Lang and Susie Britton and featured the song Blur, an upcoming single by Bay Area musician Maya Picciotto. We'll feature Maya again as we leave you tonight, performing a cover of the song, cover of Lasa de Sela. The song is called Pa Llegar a Tu Lado. Good night and thanks for listening. Stay safe. Dumb.